I can do things at Wed without asking anybody, even my
wife. Coney Island, world's biggest barrel of
and
fun.
And anywhere else your imagination takes you.
Okay, we've done that. Now what?
You get the whole show now. You hurry, hurry, hurry.
Anything's possible at Disneyland.
Welcome aboard the Themed Attraction Podcast, where we take you for a ride through the wonderful world of theme park design, that is. You've just set sail on a journey of discovery and discussion with theme park industry masters of the craft. I'm your skipper, Freddie Martin, and bobbing along the river with me, as always, is experienced designer, master planner, and chief creative officer of Storyland Studios, Mel McGowan. Hey, where's the river going to take us today, Mel?
Well, we're taking the long way around today with someone whose career has had as many bends and turns as an Intamin megacoaster. Joe Lanzicero has served as a senior creative executive for Walt Disney Imagineering, leading development in Disney's theme parks, cruise line, resorts, restaurants, and retail. But unlike some of today's Imagineers, and more like Walt's original team of WED, Joe's career started off at the animation desk, creating some of Disney's beloved animated features.
Yeah, I can't wait to get into this. All right, folks, keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the boat, because this episode is about to leave the dock. Hit it, Sam. So, Mel, today our guest is somebody who has began his career in a totally different way than how he has now sort of coming towards the end of his career. Joe Lanzicero started out as a CalArts trained animator, somebody who began, you know, drawing cells, doing special effects, creating backgrounds for set pieces in animation, and came to become, you know, one of the most relied upon designers in Walt Disney Imagineering. That is pretty incredible.
Agreed. You know, and it's a lot of people think it's a more of a natural move from animation into Imagineering. And, you know, there's a few guys that made that move, like Mark Davis, a few of those Disney Imagineers. But it's actually not as common as you would think. Even a lot of the original legendary Imagineers that we think of were guys that Walt had to kind of pluck from other live action studios like 20th Century Fox specifically to bring over because they had that real world architecture or set design experience. So Joe is really kind of a unique story that's increasingly rare these days.
Yeah, I love it. And we, you know, we talk about this, about disciplines, the disciplines that are used within themed entertainment design, right? But when you think about animation, you go back to that time and you know, if you've ever studied animation at all or watched any of the old Walt Disney Presents type of shows where he talks about animation, you recognize that character design is one type of discipline, that background art is a discipline, set design is a discipline, and all of these animators and filmmakers have some disciplines that somehow, some way made it into the themed entertainment industry, or, you know, through folks like Mark Davis or like Joe will say today. So how do you think those disciplines of art design, character design, set design, how do they become those ideal personnel for designing this new concept in a kiddie park?
Well, I don't know about the kiddie park thing, but, you know, I think, you know, one of the common threads between animation and spatial storytelling or Imagineering and theme park design is the need for some pretty extreme efficiency. You can't have this kind of sloppy or egotistical director that wants to just shoot hundreds of hours of film and then leave it to the poor guy in the editing room to somehow, you know, edit that into somewhat of a cohesive script, because of all the time, length, energy, painstaking, hand-drawn, you know, the work that goes into every single frame, much like every brick and piece of mortar or, you know, character paint and plaster that goes into physically building out these worlds. I mean, it just requires a lot of strategic and advanced planning and thinking and, again, editing the core story and knowing what the heart of that story is and the emotional kind of arc and kind of thinking through all that stuff before you just start building every idea that you have or building everything that you can draw. So I think that's a big overlay common thread. But then the other thing that I personally really appreciate about both this industry and what I would actually, I think a lot of others would argue is kind of one of the few truly collective art forms in the world is exactly that. It really is a unique thing where it takes such a unique, diverse skill set. You know, we always call our team a motley crew, you know, that complementary, diverse skill set from artists, architects, artisans, accountants, project managers. You know, just it is just such a diverse array of backgrounds. And even in the original animated films, you know, the complementary skill set, you think of an Ub Iwerks and, you know, whatever mm-hmm. original talent he had, for example, as a faster hand yeah. than Walt Disney ever could be, if not a better hand at drawing Mickey and, you know, animating some, you know, his technical competence and expertise and drive for experimentation and R&D really ultimately led to even more significant contributions to the Walt Disney Company and Walt Disney personally. So, you know, people just bring this unique mix of gifts and talents to the table and folks that, you know, can leverage that and let them shine and not keep them in the box maybe that they were hired into, you know, will do really well for themselves and for their projects.
That's absolutely true. And I've seen it firsthand. Well, our guest today is Joe Lancicero. Joe is a 30-year Disney veteran who began began in animation, actually, and graduated to Imagineering, where he eventually became known as the theme park land expansion guy. He expanded so many, including Critter Country and Toontown in Anaheim and Toy Story Land, Grizzly Gulch, and Mystic Point in Tokyo. Today, Joe is executive vice president at Zeitgeist Design. He's creative directing many projects for theme parks and cruise lines, museums, and more. And he's one of the world's top go-to guys for experience design. So for user experience design, I should say. Well, let's get busy. It's time to dive in with our interview with Mr. Joe Lancicero.
Hey, Joe. Great to see you.
Hey, Mel. Good to see you here virtually.
It's been way too long.
On my computer screen.
Yeah. Like I said, I think the last time we physically got together was Marty Sklar's house. So that was a way back machine. I think you were still sharing some fun stuff on Disney Cruise Line.
I was with the cruise line. Exactly.
I'm sorry I couldn't get my visa fast enough to join you in China for that awesome Chimlong project.
That would have been so much fun, but, you know, could happen again.
Yeah,
you never know.
Share some chow mein with you sooner rather than later. But we
yeah. Oh, they have those sumptuous Chimelong buffets, not to be missed.
Yeah, right. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Crazy.
Awesome. Well, we've enjoyed the collaborative partnerships between Storyland and Zeitgeist, but we are excited to have you on to really talk about your whole career trajectory. From the CalArts days, and in a lot of ways, I feel like you're one of the few, the proud that have followed kind of almost Walt's trajectory from 2D animation to theme parks and beyond. So this is awesome.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, and it's kind of a it was an interesting set of coincidences that kind of led me to where I ended up. Because it was never really planned. It was just opportunities that popped up along the way. And I'm kind of an opportunist if something's there. And I was always guided by two things. I'd ask myself, is this more fun than what I am doing now? And if the answer was yes, I pursued it.
Well, that jump from 2D to 3D, I can't imagine a more perfect either IP or theme land than Toontown.
Yes.
That just seems like such a perfect fit to bring you into that world.
Yeah. And again, it was an opportunity that was just presented to me. It wasn't something looking back, I can't think of anything that I actively pursued. Mm-hmm. It was always And I was very fortunate because there were always people around me. You mentioned Marty Sklar early on. And probably more than anybody in my career and in my life, I have to look to Marty for seeing more in me than I saw in myself. Mm-hmm. And always providing me with great opportunities. And I also know that Marty, you know, understood Imagineering, understood the whole, what it takes to make a great theme park attraction or to work in the themed entertainment industry. So I always felt honored when I got an opportunity from Marty, because I knew if anybody knew what they were doing, it was Marty. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, you know, I probably wouldn't have, you know, got to do all the things that I did had it not been for Marty early on. Now, there were others, too, along the way. Tony Baxter was very instrumental in getting me involved in Imagineering. And then once I was in Imagineering, there were great people along the way. So I really have I owe a debt of gratitude to all those along the way who saw more than me than I saw in myself.
Well, isn't that a lot of the way that we see this industry kind of flow, is that there can be this hand, one hand reaching up, another hand reaching down, helping people kind of sort of move along the way. Certainly there's politics and there's all that stuff, but you do find a sense of sort of camaraderie and brotherhood that helps.
And, you know, and I try to remember that even today. I mean, any chance I have to do something like we're doing today, where I can pass along a little knowledge, pass along a story that someone might learn from. Definitely love working with the newer generation of artists that are out there. You know, I was given, you know, there were certain circumstances and opportunities that I was given through my education at CalArts, through the various people I got to work with, both at Disney Animation and at Imagineering. I mean, I was very fortunate because I was of the generation that we were the last group that got to be handed down the magic tablets of knowledge from Disney's nine old men.
Yeah, right.
You know, I got to work with Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson and Eric Larson. I don't know if these names mean a lot to the theme park world, but these were the guys that worked directly with Walt. I can honestly say, you know, Mark Davis was a good friend. I used to go to his house and drink martinis with him. So I was Ward Kimball. Yeah, I got to know Ward pretty well. I'd go and hang in his train and toy collection and over in San Gabriel. And in fact, after Ward passed away, I actually bought a big collection of his art from his family.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, I was very, very, and I don't take it for granted. Yeah. I mean, and these guys were great teachers, some more generous than others. And, you know, their desire to teach and their willingness to give information. But all of them, you know, if you sat with your ears open and your heart open, your mind open, you always got some gem from them that you could take and apply to something you were doing.
You know, I think that, again, that transition from 2D into the third dimension with Toontown is so unique. I had a personal unique experience. I had just started at Disney, and I climbed over the hill illegally to peer on the almost complete Toontown construction site, and it was kind of a vision of a different type of reality, and it was just, I think, the perfect arrival sequence that I wish everyone, you know, kind of could stumble, you know, upon that kind of first view. But what a paradigm shift in really the first IP-based land. A lot of times we think about Harry Potter and some other stuff, but to make a decision to commit to doing an entire theme land, especially for the original Disneyland park around an original IP, and then even marrying that with the Fab Five that had never had a physical environment. Can you share some of the kind of creative heavy lifting that was involved with kind of landing the plane on that big idea?
Yeah. You know, as you said, it was, again, I believe it was Marty and others who saw what I was doing. When I made the transition from feature animation to Imagineering, first few things I got to do were character-based projects. They were looking to redo the Tiki Room down in Florida.
Right.
And remember, this was when Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg had just come on board, and they had all their Hollywood friends. They were making all these movies with Bette Midler and Danny DeVito. And so they wanted to use all this talent and redesign and redress the birds and do this crazy show that was basically caricatured birds based on these actors. So I designed the whole show, you know, designing the birds to look like these characters. I was working with Kevin Rafferty and Mark Rhodes, I think, was the other writer. And the three of us came up with this show. And Marty loved it. And I remember he was having a hard time getting a meeting with Michael Eisner. And again, another great Marty story where it showed his dedication and passion when he liked something. I remember him asking us, and this was before computers and before you could do do a deck online and, yeah. and have a keynote presentation. So he asked us to put together a book of the whole show with all my drawings in it, because he knew he was going to be in an airplane with Michael and wanted to seize the opportunity to sit with Michael and show him the show. The show never got done, but what it did do was give a lot of people an insight into what I could do and what I could bring to Imagineering. In fact, it was Tony Baxter who really pushed to bring me over to Imagineering, because he said at the time there were a lot of people that understood creating environments, but he said we were missing, and I will never compare myself with Mark Davis because I put Mark on a pedestal. But I do think I brought a lot of the same kind of thinking that Mark brought, because we came from the same place, you know, thinking about how to stage things simply through, because animation was all about, you had 24 frames mm-hmm. to do a scene, and you had to be able to, you know, quickly understand, you know, how am I going to communicate this particular thing quickly, effectively, understand what the story point was or is, and make it funny, make it sad, make it dramatic, whatever it takes to get that across. So I always tried to, through everything I ever did, always try to think that way about, you know, is it entertaining? Is it fun? Is it communicating? And those were all tools that I learned in animation and brought with me. So so getting back to Toontown, as I'm rambling on here, so they saw that I had that ability. And, you know, at the time they had done this Mickey's Birthday Land down in Florida.
Yes.
And it was highly successful, mostly because what it did was guaranteed the guests a place where they could see Mickey. Mm-hmm. And that's what was missing at Disneyland. But fortunately, again, it was, and everything in life, you know, is about timing, being at the right place at the right time and, you know, making the planets have converged and you just happen to be standing there. And that's what happened with Toontown. So they wanted to do this land where you could meet the characters. You know, and the company was in this huge, huge boom, building boom at the time. They were doing Euro Disneyland, yeah. a studio down in Florida. There were Typhoon Lagoon. I mean, it was the beginning of the Disney decade. And, you know, with Michael and Frank Wells, they wanted to leave their mark. And they certainly were pushing to get all this stuff done. And so initially it was just going to be, Toontown was just going to be the little neighborhood where you could meet Mickey. And the main thing was about meeting Mickey. But Michael Eisner also had this new character and this new movie they were working on called Roger Rabbit, yep. and wanted to make Roger kind of his Mickey Mouse, and was willing to go big with that. And so we had started working on Toontown, and it was just going to be Mickey's Toontown in the little neighborhood. And we were about, I don't know, well into the design when we got the challenge, not the challenge, the direction from those guys to do the whole Roger Rabbit side of the project, which was the downtown. And at first I was, oh God, I go, how the heck are we going to make, you know, this new cartoon work with these classic characters? But in the end, it all worked out great because it was all one world. You know, we were creating this cartoon world that you could walk into, and it actually created a nice counterpoint to what we were doing with the Mickey piece, which was this cute little suburban kind of neighborhood. And then we had this great contrast of the downtown, which was from, you know, the Toontown from Roger Rabbit, which was kind of an edgy place, yeah, you right. know? It was very urban and brick. So we had the cute little neighborhood houses with, you know, green trees and the green mountain behind it. And then the other side, this kind of urban piece to it. So in the end, it turned out to have become a nice yin to the yang of what we were doing.
And also really true to the original Roger Rabbit film. Which were all those characters, and even the Disney Warner characters kind of coexisted.
I mean, they were just all living in the same world. So it all worked. Bottom line, it was, again, very fortuitous that it all came together. And I think it works as a cohesive piece of, you know, environmental storytelling. And yes, I'm proud to say, I think it was one of the first real IP-driven lands. Not so much like the Harry Potter world, where, you know, it was so based directly on the movie, the things that people had seen. I mean, we had to create kind of our world more, because a lot of the places that we wanted to bring guests to really didn't exist. Like, there wasn't a Mickey's house,
right.
But we knew enough about Mickey and his character and all the little, we watched, you know, hundreds of shorts and we were able to get into the head of Mickey, you know, the gestalt of Mickey and figure out, you know, who he would be. And we actually, there was actually some arguments with some individuals whose names I won't mention, some of the higher ups, who didn't like the idea that we were putting Mickey in this cute little bungalow. You know, they wanted to see something more grandiose. They said, well, you know, he's the corporate icon.
Oh, he is, yeah.
We said, yeah, but, you know, Mickey is every man.
Yeah,
you know, he was the leader of the gang, and, you know, and he's a sweet, and he's
it's more his character. It's more his character in the films that he plays than it is his corporate, I'm the actor who rules. I just recently did a deep dive on the story of Toontown and the idea that it takes place, like, you know, Tomorrowland takes place in, well, I guess 1986, back when 55, in 1955, and Frontierland takes place sometime in the 1850s, I suppose, but Toontown is actually set in a date, July 17th, 1955. It's meant to be that date, and that it's always opening day in Toontown, which is a really really cool concept that still stands. Nobody thinks of that when they walk in there, but there's the hints and clues.
I find it kind of ironic that I think you're right. You totally made it your own, and you had to do some pretty creative art direction to transfer those 2D films and all those different styles and genres into a real believable place. But I find it ironic that, you know, kind of the one of the first IP based lands, and then ultimately getting to do a couple of original IP lands, I guess, ground up at Hong Kong Disneyland with is it Grizzly Gulch and Mystic Manor, and, you know, with your background in character animation, it does remind me of kind of those Claude Coates, Mark Davis magic combo where, you know, from a blank slate, you create this instantly understandable, believable world, you know, with rich character and setting ground up. Which one was more fun for you? And was that kind of daunting? Was it just a unique opportunity that was one of the last opportunities that any of us get in the industry for a long time?
Well, for me, it literally was one of the last opportunities, because it was one of the last things I got to do before I left Disney. Was it more? You know what? Every project was fun, and I always tried to look for the fun in what we were doing. And I think if you went back and talked to the people that were on my teams, you know, that's what I really tried to instill in the teams that did these projects. Especially, you know, as you know, when I was doing Toontown, I was still designing. A lot of the little buildings and the houses, you know, Goofy's house and Minnie's house. You know, I did the original, you know, first concept drawing. We had others that took them. I mean, Don Carson, who is, in my opinion, one of the greatest, you know, theme park designers out there still today, in fact. You know, he did a lot of the great work for us. You know, we had a good team of people. But back then, I was still actually designing. By the time I got around to when we were doing Hong Kong Disneyland, I was actually in charge of three portfolios. at the time when we started the expansion in Hong Kong, I was the senior vice president in charge of the Tokyo Resort, and we were doing major attractions there. We were doing the Tower of Terror in Tokyo Disney Seas. We were doing the Monsters attraction in Tokyo Disneyland. Simultaneously, I was given the assignment to go into Hong Kong Disneyland and lead the design effort on the expansion there. And then if that wasn't enough, at the same time, I remember being taken to some industry dinner by at the time, Bruce Vaughn and, who was the gentleman? I forget who the executive was at the time. And they said, hey, you know, we got this cruise ship thing and, you know, Wing Chow has been doing a great job, but Wing wants to move on. And, you know, we think you're the right guy for the job. And I foolishly said, yes.
You wanted to see more of the world, I think.
Well, actually, to that point, that's a good segue, Freddie. In 1 year, I did 6 around the world trips during that period, because I was, like I said, we had projects coming out of the ground in Tokyo. We had projects coming out of the ground in Hong Kong, and we were building the ships in Germany. So I would usually either fly in either east or west around the globe, stopping in Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Germany, or Germany, Tokyo, Hong Kong. And that was crazy. But my point about bringing all that up, by that point in my career, it was really about, I saw myself as the guy who made sure everybody were focused in on what were the core attributes of what we were trying to do. And I use this analogy of the conductor in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. And a great conductor, he has to know the score really well and the nuances of what makes that piece of music great. So that I equate then to the, what is the core story idea that we're trying to do, and what is the design aesthetic that we're trying to achieve in that project. So that's number two. And then the second thing a conductor does is understand his musicians and understands their strengths and weaknesses. You know, you've got your first chair musicians. Those are the guys that, you know, really know what they're doing. But and then the third thing is to make sure everybody knows their part and what they're doing and acknowledging them. And even if it's a guy playing the triangle that's hitting one little bell note, you know, every 20 bars or something, you got to make him understand that that's really important, because without that little ding, this whole thing isn't going to work. So I really tried to keep that as kind of the way I looked at what I was doing, especially when I got to that point when I had so many people working and so much stuff going on. And to keep it light and to keep it fun and to keep it moving. Yeah.
Well, that's a really important part of great leadership. I mean, I know when I've worked under great leaders that think that way as a conductor, to use your example. I know when I've worked for them that it's not, you know, it's either their way or the highway, or they forget that they're being held up by so many. And it's so important, especially with creatives. Right. Yeah. To be listening.
Oh, yeah. We're an eccentric group.
Yes. to be sure.
It's ironic. You almost end up taking on some of Marty's kind of type of leadership requirements, even though you could also draw circles really well. Is there any times where it was kind of just almost frustrating because you would be tempted to just try to block out some time and design? You know, where, you know.
And I did, you know, and it's not that I completely stopped designing, even like a lot of the work I'm doing today. You know, I try to, you know, do as many little kind of idea sketches and art direction sketches. But again, I always know that and try to understand the person that I'm handing it off to, you know, what their strengths are. And I always hope to be surprised that they're going to take what I did and make it better, or maybe put a different spin on it. And that actually goes back to one of the principles we learned in animation and what they did at the studio. And it was called plussing. And the idea was not to change what the person working with you or who was part of the process, like in animation, you know, you had You had animators, cleanup artists, layout artists, and again, learning from the guys that worked directly with Walt, they always talked about how he told them to try to plus what you were doing. And that didn't mean change it. That just was to look at the core of what was being done and how your piece, you know, how you could take your piece and make it better. Mm-hmm. So I learned, you know, even though I might have had a different vision for something in my head than what another artist had done, to kind of try to disconnect my vision from what they did and look at it with open and honest eyes and say, hey, okay, this is not what I did, but is it different? And if it's different, is it better? Mm-hmm. Or if it's different, does it, you know, have a stronger whatever about it? But, you know, trying to be honest about you know, disconnecting our own prejudices or our own preconceived idea about something. And if you can do that, most of the time you're going to be surprised.
Yeah.
And the work that you're going to get from people, you know, and they're going to feel more appreciated too.
Yeah, and empowered to do something better the next time.
Yes,
they won't have that fear.
Right. And that was kind of the whole prevailing, that this whole idea of plussing and, you know, working as a team that goes all the way back to the, you know, those formative years in animation. And I think that's why those films were always so incredible, you know. And I know because, you know, I went to school with John Lasseter, and a lot of what John brought to Pixar and why those Pixar films, you know, the early, well, even to today, but I mean, that's kind of what I think John left behind at Pixar, was that idea of the team and plussing the work and, you know, staying focused on the core story ideas and the character personalities. I mean, those were all the things that we learned back at CalArts.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful stuff. You know, I might be mistaken in this, but I think like Grizzly Gulch and Mystic Point were maybe the last two non-IP based lands, at least by Disney and Universal, in the industry. What was the process like of getting those greenlit and kind of conceived and approved? Was it?
You know, I have to thank the Hong Kong government, because, you know, the park there in Hong Kong was a partnership with the Hong Kong government and Disney. And in fact, the Hong Kong government had just, you know, like, Disney had 49% and they had 51% controlling control over the park. And they really wanted to have bragging rights. They wanted to have something that none of the other parks had. And they asked for original ideas.
Yeah.
And originally when we did the expansion and we expanded the park by 25%, you know, that park was built during the that time when Paul Pressler felt like you could do the minimal amount to call something a Disney park. But what he didn't realize that, you know, like a great brand, like imagine going to a McDonald's and you couldn't get a Big Mac.
Right.
That was the analogy, because it's too expensive. You know, if we put two pieces of beef in that Big Mac, it's going to cost X. So we're going to call this thing a Big Mac, but only put one piece of beef in it. Well, no, people are going to go, what are you trying to sell me here, buddy?
Where's the beef?
Yeah. and you know, and that was Hong Kong Disneyland. And I don't fault the design. I never faulted Imagineering for, you know, some of the hiccups that came out of that period, the initial Disney's California Adventure, because if you look, you know, at the same time Disney's California Adventure was being designed and built, they were building TDS. TDS being one of the most magnificent parks ever built. Same Imagineering did both parks, but it was just under different direction from management. So
That's a remarkable split. You've got the most magnificent park, and then some of the we'll get to them, you definitely see the difference. But
for our listeners,
nobody
by the
can
way,
blame
we,
the
we've,
time.
We've done two episodes with Tom Morris, and you know his heart and passion, you know, and the pixie dust that runs in his blood, you know, comes through. And I definitely had an amazing experience taking my son, who I was able to basically take right from the orphanage and run him through Hong Kong Disneyland. Probably the funnest Disney day in my life.
Oh my gosh!
And so, it was just really epic, and able to do that right after the park opened, and it really almost to me, felt like going to Disneyland in 1955. So there was something to that minimum, you know,
park. No, I'm very good friends with Tom. In fact, Tom still does a lot of work with us with Zeitgeist. And pretty recently, we brainstormed some cool stuff together. So, you know, no, that's why I said I would never fault any of the people. You know, when I was handed an assignment, they said to fix this. Well, it really wasn't broken. It just wasn't living up to the Disney expectation. Sure. You know, it wasn't, you know, what the brand, what people know of the brand and expect from the brand.
Well, you almost like completed it was really like completing it, you know, or completing the right size and literally completing the loop around the river.
How do you tell a story when people listen with more than their ears? Stories change lives. They make us remember, but only when they're felt and not just heard. Storyland Studios builds the impossible. We turn big ideas into reality. We tell stories in three dimensions to stir the senses so you can walk into places you've only seen in your dreams, in real life, and real time. Storyland's artists, architects, and artisans take stories out of the imagination and build tangible dreams that leave lasting impressions and memories that endure for years. What's your story? Storyland Studios is themed entertainment, destination design, production, and fabrication. Connect with the team at Storyland Studios to get started building your impossible dream today. Visit storylandstudios.com or call now, 800-218-1932. That's 800-218-1932. Storyland Studios, your big ideas' best ally.
So, you know, so getting back to your question about the two original IP lands, initially there were going to be three original IP lands in the expansion for Hong Kong. The third being we were going to do this Arctic kind of land, because we thought Hong Kong, where it's 1,000 degrees, and how cool would it be to actually, really, literally cool, to go into this, like, Arctic outstation, you know, somewhere, you know, in the North Pole, or South Pole. I can't remember which one it was, but it was snowy, and we had some cool little toboggan-like rides and things in it. But again, it was our Hong Kong partner who was a little concerned because the kind of the competitor park, which they are also part owners in, the Hong Kong government, was Ocean Park. Mm-hmm. And they were also in the middle of an expansion. And one of the lands they were doing, even though it was very different from what we were doing, it still had this kind of Arctic theme. So, and we were well into the design. In fact, we had designed this whole third land, built the model, started drawings. And they said, no, well, you can't do it. And I remember all the angst. And so we had to scramble quickly. And that's why we made the decision to do Toy Story Land, because they had just finished it or were in the process of finishing it in Paris. I got a quick trip to Paris out of it, flew over there, met with the designers, and we were able to, you know, and they already had all the drawings for the rides and such. So our job was mostly with that to make it fit on a piece of property that was quite different from what they had in Paris. So we got to make some changes and work with the staging on some of the things, but it was basically just, you know, lifting what they had done there. And we turned that thing around in less than a year.
Wow.
And got it open really quick. So we staggered the opening of the three lands. First, Toy Story Land, because, again, the rides were, the manufacturers had all the molds and the plans, and also it was quickly to turn that around. Grizzly was second. Not that it was easy land to do, because it was very... if you've seen it, there's a lot of interface and between the landscape and the coaster and the buildings. I think one of the most interesting pieces of that design is the way the coaster works with the rest of the land. And again, tip of the hat to another unsung hero in our industry, Robert Coltrane. Robert was, I mean, he's one of those guys that worked on, his hand is on so many projects, but you never hear about it. Like he did Everest at the initial design for Everest at Walt Disney World. He and others worked on, I think he was one of the first to help work out the whole Midway Mania, the original Midway Mania. Anyway, Robert, can't say enough great things about Robert Coltrane, and he has since retired from Disney as well. But he was the one that worked out how the coaster worked with the, and we had a very tight budget on all three lands. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of is how much we got for that budget. We had the same budget as they had for, and they were doing it around the same time for Cars Land at Disneyland. Now, Cars Land has a lot of rock work, gigantic rock work, you know, very complicated ride system with the racing car ride. But I mean, basically there they got three rides and one land for the same amount of money that we got three lands with three, four, five, six rides, you know, restaurants. I mean, we got quite a bit out of it. So again, I think it was a testament to the team and testament to us trying to make sure that every nickel got in front of the guests. You know, we really fought hard, and the back of house stuff is always important. And making sure that we always, and this was another thing I always tried to do, and this goes back to the animation, you know, always understanding the hierarchy of what you're trying to do when you're communicating something. Even when you look at a scene in a movie or in an animated film, and this is also a lot of great learnings from Mark Davis. He was a king at this. And I often use the example of course, Pirates is probably the gold standard for great, you know, visual storytelling. Yep. And something like the dunking of the mayor scene, when you turn that corner, if you think about how much information is put in front of you in that initial turn, but you're never confused because Mark was a genius at knowing how to create a hierarchy of importance. You know, the first thing you needed to see was the mayor being dunked, because that's the core story idea. And then your eye flows to, you know, the other citizens that are next to be dumped in there, and then the one guy with the gun. Anyway, if you study that, there's a lesson in great, clear hierarchy of storytelling. Mm-hmm. So we always would sit when we were designing these things and say, okay, A, what's the A thing? What's the most important thing we want guests to focus on and to take away? And then what's the B thing, the thing that supports that? And then how does everything else work to support B and A? And if you do that, then you're not going to be spending money in stupid places where people aren't going to look. I mean, I walk through a lot of stuff today and I see these beautifully, I mean, almost overly done, you know, shops or queue lines or whatever. And I'm impressed, but I'll also have to stop and go, they didn't need to spend that much to tell that story idea or to create the emotional connection to that thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, again, is based out of experience, but also based out of those learnings from animation and the masters about, you know, where to put the bang, where to get the, you know, the most bang from the buck. It's about understanding how you want to communicate something and creating a hierarchy in how you're communicating it.
Makes so much sense when you're being super efficient, because it takes so much work for every frame. That you're not going to be wasting a lot of time unnecessary stuff. Not a lot left on the cutting room floor when it takes that much effort for every frame.
So over there on Mystic Point is the first themed ride with a reference to a member of the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, Dr. Henry Mystic.
The first entire themed land.
Based on the
sea member.
That's been sort of a fun little track to follow for the fans. Yeah. And I think it's one of these sort of Imagineer. It's almost like the Pixar Easter eggs. There's always some secretly hidden thing. And I think you guys have done a really good job about doing or really tried hard to build that story into that. Tell me a little bit about that and like how that comes about and what where you guys go with that, with an idea that's, hey, how do I take the obscure and elevate it just a little bit so that people are curious?
It's, and you know what? It's not so much, it's obscure, but I talk about this actually in a lot of the work I do with the UX groups about storytelling and how you apply storytelling. There's two ways you apply storytelling, I believe, in the theme park. And there's story as narrative and there's story as subtext. Narrative, I mean, of course, is when it's based, usually based on a known IP, you know, something like Harry Potter, or like Monsters or Toy Story, you know, where people know the stories, they know the characters. So your job then as a theme park designer is to make sure you give the guests those trigger points, those things that they saw in the movie, they heard the music, you know, they love those characters. So make sure that, you know, you're giving them that kind of a physical narrative of this thing they know from the film.
Yes.
But then the story is subtext, which actually we used a lot on the cruise ship, you know, is creating a story or taking a known story, and you're using it more as a design tool. Mm. Everybody, it's kind of a script or a manifesto that everybody working on that project buys into, agrees to it, and then uses it to make your design choices. So going back to Tokyo Disney Sea, you know, they had created the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, and we used that to create the backstory for our Tower of Terror there, which was Harrison Hightower, yep, who was loosely based and physically based on Joe Rohde, and this idea that he was this world explorer.
Is he frozen for you too, Mel?
Yeah, unstable connection. Might want to repeat that.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, you were about to say about Harrison Hightower.
Okay, it says my connection is unstable. Yeah, so we went in. Tokyo Disney Sea had established the story of the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, and so we kind of took that and ran with it, because when we did our Tower of Terror in Tokyo, the Japanese audience had no reference to the old
Twilight
Rod
Zone.
Sterling Twilight Zone. Yeah, exactly. So we had to come up with our own story. And it had to work in American Waterfront, the bigger theme of American Waterfront in Tokyo Disney Sea. So we came up with this backstory of this adventurer who was not the most scrupulous and went around the world kind of pilfering, you know, artifacts to populate his big hotel. And then, of course, one of them is cursed and blah, blah, blah. So there was a lot of story there. And we actually, one of those great theme park unsung heroes is this guy Chuck Ballou, who's did a ton of work for me in Tokyo. And he really did. He was one of those guys that would dive way deep into things. And he actually made a comic book about Harrison Hightower and going to Africa and stealing Shuriki Utundu and bringing him back. And that kind of became our design Bible, you know. And once we knew, you know, who he was and what he did and what his personality was about, then it's easy when you can start making your design choices. When you say, well, what would the inside of his hotel look like? Well, he visited this place and he brought back this, so it's going to look like this. So we had that's a good example as story as a subtext. It's not that it doesn't manifest itself in a physical way the same way story as narrative does, but it's not always so overt. I mean, because you it's the same kind of tools you're using, but a lot of it is just about what's happening below the surface, mm-hmm, what the designers are using below the surface. Mm-hmm. So we took that same kind of thinking and applied it to Mystic Point and Lord Henry Mystic. And he just so happened to be, he was a lot like Harrison Hightower, you know, traveled around the world collecting artifacts, but he did it from this pure place, from this elevated place. He, you know, he studied, again, this is all the backstory stuff that we came up with, you know, understanding who he was, you know. And then creating the relationship between him and Albert the monkey. You know, we wanted to show this kind of maternal side to him, that he had the softer side, and that the monkey becomes like his son, But the monkey is also our surrogate. You know,
yes.
We design the ride that you're kind of seeing it through the monkey's eyes, and the monkey goes through kind of looking at, you know, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey about, you know, discovering, you know, his destiny and what he should and shouldn't do. And he learns things along the way. It's also a little analogous to the Journey to the West, mm-hmm. you know, the Monkey King having to learn from his mistakes and comes out the other side a better person. So all this is kind of subtext stuff that, and it's there, and a lot of it, you know, if you dig just a little below the surface, you're going to find it, but it just works as a great design tool. And it also is fun, like where we're going back to this whole, see the Society of Explorers and Adventurers. In fact, even one of the last things on the cruise ship that I worked on when we redid the play area on I think it was on the Disney Magic, because it had the old play area and then we turned it into the newer play area that was similar to what we did on the newer ships. We incorporated, there's a little understory of another member of the SEA. It was and it's a woman character, and I can't remember what we called
Mary
her.
Mary Oceaneer.
There she is. So it all gets all connected. And hopefully, I hope there's some Imagineers out there working on something right now and taking that core idea and going somewhere with it, because I think it's fun.
Yeah. But,
the other tie-in with Mystic Point that just makes perfect sense in Hong Kong is that fun, whimsical, redemptive way of tying in that legacy of British colonialism
in Hong Kong.
But, yeah, kind of appropriate for that specific context.
Yeah, but that's always not a really good story.
Right, exactly.
So we had to gloss over that a little
tricky fine line there.
Yeah. You're walking on kind of.
Often it depends on who you make the hero. In Harrison Hightower's case, you get to say, "Well, there he is. He's the bad guy. We don't like." you know, Mel, you brought up, or Joe, you brought up the cruise line. But as Mel and I were prepping for the conversation, he brought up The Art of Animation, which is one of my favorite books, then The Alchemy of Imagineering, right? There's this blend of the two, which when you take – I understand it in animation. I understand it in theme parks in those spaces. But now you've brought both of those into the cruise ship. Tell us about that. You know, a cruise ship seems limiting, but you managed to do so well in that, in the Disney Cruise Line.
Well, first, thank you for that compliment. You know, it goes back to all that same thinking I tried and my teams tried to bring to all the things we did. And that's about, you know, thinking about entertainment, thinking about the story, and always, of course, the Disney brand and mm-hmm. what guest expectations are for the Disney brand. The cruise ship, my involvement with the cruise ship actually went back to the original two ships, the Magic and the Wonder. I worked on those back in the early and mid-90s in a much lesser capacity than I did when I was in charge of the design on the Dream and the Fantasy. But again, it was the same thing. In fact, I'd gotten some good learnings from those early days on the initial design of the cruise ships, because at the time when those ships were being designed, there was really no family cruising market. Mm-hmm. There was one, I think it was the Big Red Boat.
That's right.
That had licensed Disney characters, and then Disney pulled the license, and they had Warner Brothers characters. But the whole idea of creating something for the family was an afterthought. Mm. You know, it wasn't part of the core design of the experience. And so when we initially started to work on the original ships, and at that time there was Disney Development Company, and they were leading the design. And they had just brought Imagineering and kind of help with some of the, quote, kind of specialty things. But the audience at that time was mostly older people or young people, and not really families. So there was this concern or this caution about how much Disney are we going to put on this ship, because we don't want to alienate that cruise audience. Because at the time, that was the bread and butter of the industry. Mm-hmm. So you can understand where their thinking was, you know, where they were careful about, oh, my God, if Mickey Mouse is everywhere, you know, this is going to, you know, it might alienate these people.
Ironically, but we had the same challenge when Disney bought the Disneyland Hotel in California. Finally, the convention salespeople were so nervous about losing these massive room blocks of conventions because they thought everyone's just going to put in Mickey Mouse bed sheets. But that same kind of thinking that we want to keep the core, you know, adult business doing its thing without messing it up with all this Disney magic and wonder stuff. Yeah.
So that was kind of the fine line that we had to walk. I mean, it was acknowledging the strength and the power of the brand. And, you know, when getting back to my Big Mac analogy, you know, if someone goes to McDonald's, they go to McDonald's because, and by the way, I don't think I've ever had a McDonald's, but it's a great, it's a good analogy, but you know, if, people go, you know, to buy a certain brand, a Starbucks, for example, you know, because it delivers a certain product that's consistent and they know what it's all about and they make some kind of connection with that product. So on the cruise ship, we had to find that we had to walk this fine line between how much Disney and where to put the Disney and how to modulate the Disney. And early on, we had a lot of discussions about the fact that it was kind of a different storytelling form. You know, the theme park, you tell stories in 3 to 20 minutes. You know, a coaster is maybe a 2 to 3 minute experience, maybe a nice sit-down show or a 4D theater might be anywhere between 10 to 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes. But it's pretty, it's short form storytelling, you know, and it's usually targeted storytelling. Whereas on the cruise ship, we knew we were going to have guests for 3, 5, 7, or 12 days. Mm-hmm. And so you had to start thinking about how you were going to modulate the Disney experience over that many days. And again, thinking about, you know, your audience, the demographic makeup, you know, a lot of dads that are going to be, they're getting dragged onto the ship by their kids. You know, they probably don't want to be there.
They used up a bunch of vacation days.
You bet. So, hey, we got to think about all of them, you know, and so creating great adult, you know, a separate adult area with the quiet pool for the adults and the nightclub district, you know, that had some pretty sophisticated nightclubs with entertainment and, you know, great bars. You know, but balance that with these great kids areas and then thinking about, well, you know, what were those kind of communal experiences where we could bring the family together. You know, that was usually at mealtime. That's why something like Animator's Palette made so much sense. You know, something that, and it kind of leveled the playing field too, that everybody could go in there and have a great experience. So, you know, even though you think, oh, this is so different from the theme park or animated films, I think if you really, again, scratch below the surface and think about, you know, how do you deliver on the promise of Disney and the brand of Disney? You know, the core things have to be there. It's just more in this regard about thinking about how you modulate them and how much you put where and to what, you know, and how much you emphasize them where.
Yeah, I think the mix is ends up being just right.
And then going beyond Disney, you know, how is that applied on some of your favorite projects in China and beyond? You know, because again, that range from being able to do a 4 or 5 minute attraction to a 4 or 5 day fully encapsulated experience, you can do it all.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it's just using all those same tools and all that same kind of thinking. I mean, I am who I am. You know, you can't change a tiger's stripes. You know, I was born in Burbank, California, in the shadow of the Disney Studios, and grew up watching, you know, Walt on Sunday night, and you know, being in love with Disney cartoons, but also loving Warner Brothers cartoons. You know, and that kind of formed my way of thinking and my sensibilities, and then being able to go through the CalArts experience and have the influence from all my great fellow students there and the great teachers. So, you know, it's kind of just, you know, in my DNA, the way I look at things and the way I want to approach doing things and making sure it's entertaining and fun and always good communication is at the core of it. I mean, a lot of the work that I'm doing currently with in the UX sector is it all comes down to communicating and emotional connection. You know, I think what going back to Walt and his great quote, you know, behind every smile, there's a tear, or is it behind every tear, there's a smile? You know, that idea that, you know, you need to touch people emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the strength of having a good IP. You know, it does a lot of the heavy lifting for you in that regard. You know, if you saw the Harry Potter films, you know who those characters are. You laughed with them. You cried with them. You know, and so, you know, it's a lot of it.
Yeah, just, you know, appreciate you, Joe. We'll have you down to the studio.
Human nature, human emotions, and making sure you're always thinking about that and remembering your user, you know?
Sorry about that.
Who's
we'll have you down to the studio.
And what do they want to get out of this experience? And making sure you're satisfying.
Thanks so much, Joe. Appreciate
them,
you. That's great.
That emotional thing that they're going to take home with them.
That's a great way to send us out.
I mean, outro.
You really did encapsulate really an hour-long conversation, which is I could keep going. Just really enjoying picking your brain and hearing your experience, not just from sort of the, hey, I worked on theme parks, but really getting into the meaning behind the work and then the results of the work. It's just been fascinating to talk with you, Joe. Really appreciate you today.
It was my absolute pleasure. It was super fun, and I hope I can do it again sometime.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back. We got to always have reunion shows.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, thank you, guys, and good questions, and that was wonderful.
Well, the joy that Joe has really has a tendency to rub off, don't you think? He's just got such a caring and fun voice to listen to. I could listen to him all afternoon.
Definitely contagious.
Definitely. Well, so at the end of the interview there, I was listening. Joe talked about the length of time it takes to tell a story in a variety of experiences. He's talking about like a 2-minute roller coaster, a 7-minute dark ride, or, you know, in the cruise line, you have to tell a story over 6 days of a voyage. So those things, to be able to do that in a really effective way, it takes a special set of disciplines and the skills to inject the story that has been predetermined at the head, you know, in the blue sky phase. They take that storytelling, whether it's long form or short form. So, Mel, as you are sort of leading and creative leading teams like this, how do you find people like Joe? You know, he's pretty unique, but how do you find people like Joe, people with those broad skills that can help create a cohesive story?
You know, a lot of times it's easier to find people that want to be like Joe, you know, early on. You know, for us, it's been about... you know, both kind of trying to nurture that next generation of you know, making our leaders available, whether it's, you know, at university level programs, at internships, just available for informational interviews, putting information out there, whether it's thought leadership, whether it's articles, whether it's podcasts like this, just kind of getting connected and being accessible and available to people that are interested, regardless of whatever discipline or background they're coming in. Once they get into the industry or within our team and organization, you know, again, I'm a big believer in not sticking people into their box just because they happen to you know, major in accounting or engineering or architecture. It doesn't mean that you know, that's how I'm going to see them first and foremost. I'm going to really see them as this amazingly creative creation that is full of potential. And you know, frankly, you just want to let people kind of stretch their wings, ultimately move into a place where they're able to lead either through influence or you know, actual you know, supervision or oversight. And, you know, basically, I think the people that end up becoming the strongest creative leaders and producers, whether it's the left side, right side of the brain, ultimately, they've come up through different disciplines, and they've really gained a little bit of an appreciation for what it takes to execute some of these big ideas and these stories. And they've learned how to harness the creativity of the teams and the diverse team members. It's you know, the guys with the fragile or frail egos that have to have every idea, or every idea has to be their idea, And they're just, you know, so nervous about anyone having a better idea in the room. They're really not going to, you know, kind of excel, I think, in this industry. At least they might be able to get a project done, but they're not going to be the ones that people want to work with on the next one and gravitate around. So it's kind of a short game and a long game at the same time, I think.
No, that is true. And it's really great to meet people at things like, you know, IAPA or Blue Loop or the TEA events and start to see that there's, you might be somebody with the talent that's needed. Well, it looks like the sun is sinking in the west, or is that the east? I'm not sure. We ought to turn back, and otherwise we're going to spend the night out here, Mo. Should we head back to the dock?
Let's do it.
All right. Until next time. Thanks, Mel. The Themed Attraction Podcast is hosted by Freddie Martin and Mel McGowan. We want you to know it's a big deal to us. You've taken the time to listen to our show. We do not take it for granted. Would you do us a favor and leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts? That's a great way to get the word out about the show so we can continue to connect with many more creative people just like you. We want to thank our guest, Joe Lanzicero. You can find more about Joe and follow his creative journey on Twitter at @Joe_Lanzicero or connect with him on LinkedIn. He's also part of the creative team at Zeitgeist Design and Production via zeitgeist-usa.com. Get access to more stories and interviews at themedattraction.com. Start your own profile, discuss the latest creative advancements, and interact with your fellow theme park designers around the world. Follow the action on Instagram and Twitter at themedattraction and join our active discussion group on LinkedIn. Connect with Mel by email via mel@storylandstudios.com or follow him on Twitter at Mel McGowan and Instagram at Visioneer. You can find me at freddymartin.net and follow my adventures at Skipper Freddy on Instagram and Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Rob Watson, other music provided by The Lost Dogs. This episode was designed and produced by the one and only Dr. Barry Hill. Barry's the author of a brand new book on the history of regional theme parks, with contributions from Rob Decker of Cedar Fair, Rick Bastrop, and our very own Mel McGowan. Imagineering an American Dreamscape tells the story of regional theme parks and the strong-willed visionaries behind them. Some of the stories you may have heard, most you probably haven't, and it's a fascinating tale to tell. You know, Mel, Barry had a close call in the jungle the other day. He was floating along, minding his own business, when a bloat of hippos tried to charge. Lucky for Barry, he only takes cash. Thanks for listening, folks. No, really, a group of hippos is actually called a bloat. No, I'm not kidding. Look it up. Go on.